Well, thank you. Good morning. Sue, as she said, in 2005, she invited me to speak on this material. And this is just stuff I've stumbled over. I'm no genius. Steve Benson actually quipped at Book of Mormon Tories. We were hanging out together one night, and in his own way, he kind of drummed on the tabletop, Book of Mormon Tories. And I looked at him, I thought, give me another second, I would have thought of it myself. But so he gets the credit. Anyway, I'm not going to be repeating everything from 2005, just giving highlights, important points. I'm actually from Pittsburgh myself. That's where my family got converted and where we all deconverted. And that little incline there, if you ever ride up and down that, your toes will dig itself through the floorboards trying to hang on to something because it's very terrifying. He's from there. How many knew that? Can any of you say polygamy? Try being an Aaronic priesthood holder in Pittsburgh on Super Bowl Sunday. George Washington was there, and in fact, this is the confluence of the two rivers forming the Ohio, and he thought there'd be a great place for a fort. Sidney Rigdon was there. Who knew that? Art can correct me on this. He was a Baptist minister. In Pittsburgh, which they threw him out too, didn't they?
Yes.
Solomon Spaulding is there. And notice the grave marker. He's a veteran of the American Revolution. So we're going to be talking about influences in the Book of Mormon from this era. I bring Spaulding into it, not necessarily to try to prove he was an author of the Book of Mormon, but as an interesting note. In all this material, you'll see what I'm talking about. These are my two web pages, and thank you very much to Post Mormon and Jeff Ricks, and then the good people at Mormon Think for promoting it. This is not me, but some of you may have seen this, Vernal Hawley's map, and if you scroll back and forth, you can see that the geography of the area looks a lot like the Book of Mormon when you figure in the names of places, the Narrow Neck, the Sea East, Sea West. When I first saw this, in fact, it was Steve again who introduced me to this. The light kind of went on. And I thought, well, you know, I was teetering at that time. If the Book of Mormon is a work of fiction, what's the author doing? Nothing more than what most authors do. They'll take from their experiences. Their friends' experiences. They may work in names of places that they're familiar with. Now, in the Spaulding story, which is about shipwrecked Romans who land in America, he lived there, and he says in this story, we came to the confluence of the two great rivers in which, in conjunction, produced a river called the Oahu or Ohio. But anyway, he's doing what authors do, bring in something he knows, work it into the story. This story, what we call the manuscript, Solomon Spaulding, is the defenders of the church will say that's the most, They say that's the Book of Mormon manuscript and looks nothing like the Book of Mormon, therefore the Book of Mormon wins again. The only reason we use this manuscript is because it's the only sample of his writing. It's rather clunky. Sometimes it flows, sometimes it doesn't. It's about 100 pages long. He scratches things out. He doesn't finish the story. It doesn't look like something somebody would take to a print shop to have published. But the defenders of the church will say, yes, this is the one. See, it doesn't look like the Book of Mormon, therefore we win again. Art back here on camera, presented here in 2007. And I suggest you talk to him about getting his book. He finds Solomon Spaulding and Sidney Rigdon were both in Pittsburgh at the same time, 1816. And correct me, Art, Rigdon said he wasn't there at that time?
Correct.
But there is mail waiting for him there. So if he doesn't live there, somebody's sending mail to him there. He would die a few months later after this. Now, the common story that goes with this is that Rigdon had every opportunity to make off with a manuscript by Solomon Spaulding, because they both frequented the same print shops in Pittsburgh. And so what's on file at the Oberlin College is this little story we're talking about. Now, since 2005, there was relatively not much known about the Book of Mormon, Torrey's idea. This is from the Maxwell Institute. Believers in the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham have every reason to move cautiously when citing parallels in support of their beliefs, because the use of parallels is a two-edged sword. Critics of the Book of Mormon, for example, have long cited parallels between that book of Scripture and Ethan Smith's view of the Hebrews, published before the Book of Mormon, as evidence that Joseph Smith borrowed freely from Ethan Smith. Similarly, Thomas E. Donofrio has recently attempted to prove, which is not necessarily the case, that Joseph Smith drew on such sources as David Ramsey's Life of George Washington and Mercy Otis Warren's History of the Rise, Progress, and Termination of the American Revolution in producing the Book of Mormon. This is the only quasi-official recognition of this material in any church publication. Now, there's in Fair and other places you could find reference to it, but this is the only one that the Maxwell Institute has approached. And you can see that this author exercises some intellectual integrity, because he's saying, if you're going to rely on faith-promoting parallels, what are you going to do about this? And he raised this material right next to View of the Hebrews, so I do appreciate that. And then a few years later, Craig Criddle spoke here. He was a member of a team from Stanford on using linguistics to look at the Book of Mormon versus other authors to see who the most likely author was. They used a method called the shrunken centroid classification. It's just a way to crunch numbers. He presented his material here a few years ago. This is a note from that study that's peer-reviewed at Stanford. Tom Donofrio has shown that Spalding's Oberlin manuscript, which is the Spalding story, and the Book of Mormon both contain phrases borrowed from David Ramsey, a friend and biographer of George Washington, and author of History of the American Revolution. They also contain phrases from Mercy Otis Warren, author of History of the Rise, Progress, and Termination of the American Revolution. These borrowed phrases are concentrated in sections on war within the Book of Alma, where the Spalding signal that NSC detected is most pronounced. This is a private email. I didn't mention this fellow's name. I don't wish his kindness to be rewarded by Book of Mormon defenders loading up his email. He is an editor of some of the volumes on the history that I quote. He says, "Thank you for sharing your work with me. It seems altogether credible, if not conclusive. It reminds me of an early 20th century work which documented Mary Baker Eddy's cribbings from Hegel." There's some comments here on the post-Mormon. Is Noggenus Skepticalis here today? I love that name. "The LDS apologists will dismiss such analysis as this one effortlessly. It is all right there in plain English, black and white, yet I am the fool for seeing it." And here's Miss Kate. "I felt sick while reading this." That's what I do to people. But mostly stupid to think that I sat in seminary at the beginning of my day and AP governor a few hours later at school and did not see a single parallel. This speaks to the amazing blinders that the rhetoric of the church puts on its members. I didn't know until now that consciousness of a prior naivete could actually induce nausea." There's our one author, Mercy Otis Warren. Her claim to fame is prose, elegant writing. She was also acquainted with many of the first players in the Revolution. David Ramsey, again, friend of George Washington, biographer, he predates her. And John Marshall was first Chief Justice. He also was in competition with Mercy Otis Warren for readers. He produces 5 volumes. She produces 3 volumes. Ramsey produces 2 volumes. Now, this is Marshall. He apologizes early for borrowing. He says, "Donald Lee's Annual Register, Belsham, Gordon, Ramsey," this same David Ramsey, "and Stedham have for this purpose been occasionally resorted to and are quoted for all those facts which are detailed in part on their authority. Their very language has sometimes been employed without distinguishing the passages, especially when intermingled with others, by marks of quotation, and the author persuades himself that this public declaration will rescue him from the imputation of receiving aids he is unwilling to acknowledge or of wishing by a concealed plagiarism to usher to the world as his own the labors of others." Now, Marshall excuses himself early, and later on, here's things he does. Ramsey is quoting Washington, Marshall quotes Washington, but then if you look at Marshall, he is summarizing Ramsey's summary of Washington. And it dilutes a little bit down the way. Now, had you not read Ramsey, and had you not read Marshall's apology, you would naturally assume when you read Marshall that he's just writing his own little thing. You have no idea that he's borrowing from somebody else. Now, this is another editor. This is in the front of one of those histories. This is the modern editor. First, scholarly citation, as we know it, was not an issue for 18th century writers who honored the practice, if at all, only in the most irregular and idiosyncratic manner. Second, 18th century American histories were performances, not proofs. They more nearly resemble sermons, which inspired by enunciating principles and applying them to human situations than scientific or legal discourses, which depend on for their cogency and persuasiveness on their marshaling of evidence. So two major things are going on here. Lots of borrowing, lots of sermonizing. So keep that in mind. And as you can see on the front page of Mercy Otis Warren, she's going to tell us about the history of the Revolution, including her biographical, political, and moral observations, which she likes to throw in as much as possible. So there's our popular concept of Joseph Smith translating plates, which we know is not accurate, correct? Since the advent of the internet, we have to deal with these guys and their so-called testimony of the one character at a time appearing. You know this account of Joseph Smith placing his face in the hat, seeing the English translation of each character. So when people say Joseph Smith translated, that's not according to the three witnesses that say he put his face in a hat. So which way are we going to go with this? I'm going to go with the one character at a time appearing because it works in my favor. Like that. As they say, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. Now, here's what defenders are forced into these corners because of the internet. And this is just something that was out on a blog somewhere. I saw a shocking thing the other day. A man in a park was trying to see his BlackBerry. However, it was bright outside, so he couldn't see it. I know this is going to shock you and no doubt send anti-Mormons into spasms of outrage, but believe it or not, this man took off his hat, yes, his hat, how occult of him, and put his BlackBerry into the hat, and then looked into the hat. Being shaded, he could now read what before he could not read. Did anybody explain to him that BlackBerries actually work if you put them in a hat? And if you pick up the stone in the planter next to you at the park, it's not going to... So next time you need to sell your stone and you're at the mall, just grab one. Here's another one. This is actually a published LDS author over the years. Number one point, you know, you could take it. You can take any book and find numerous similarities in thought and expression with other books. Okay? Well, and then number two, God reveals the same thoughts and expressions to different people. Well, he goes right from something rational to something subjective. Number three, ESP is another explanation. And then for Shakespeare, there's nothing new under the sun. Well, this, in his mind, is a reasonable counterargument, which then he told me I'm probably just looking for a good excuse to get out of the church. And that's why I, you know. But I thought ESP, if he ESP actually worked, he wouldn't have had to send me this email. This is a fellow I got acquainted with down in Phoenix. He's actually in Mesa, right down the street from the Mormon temple. LDS leaders will hide behind their apologists, but they will not stand behind their apologists. For very good reason, like what happened with the Mark Hoffman forgeries. Pardon the pun, but it blew up in their face. Here's another one. You probably know who this guy is. We know that Joseph Smith didn't translate in the way that a scholar would translate. He didn't know Egyptian. He proved that with the Book of Abraham, correct? There were a couple of means that were prepared for this. One was that he used an instrument that was found with the plates. That was called the Urim and Thummim. This kind of divinatory device goes back to Old Testament times. You know, this was on the PBS transcript. I'm kind of streamlining here because time's limited. He says it's kind of a strange image for us. I think it's more than a strange image. So Joseph Smith is using this telestial teleprompter word for word, which is the point I'm trying to get to here. Here's another LDS apologist. If I mentioned his name, this is a private snail mail correspondence between he and I. you would know who he is. I can't imagine how startled you were to find such striking similarities in the writings of George Washington and the Book of Mormon. But then he goes on to say that I, again, am looking for just another reason to get out of the church, and that these striking similarities are only striking to me because I'm naive, and they didn't mean a thing to him. Now, there's a fair guy out there that really took a bunch of time after this came out to do his own little study, and it was quite impressive. Lots of pages, lots of graphs. And this is his summary. I took four texts which Donofrio uses and ran them through a computerized lexical tool. Based solely on the numbers presented here, I would no more expect the Book of Mormon to be based on Warren's text any more than I would expect Jules Verne's book to be based on the Book of Mormon text. It seems reasonable that with very few sources of sufficient length, nearly the entire Book of Mormon could be reconstructed using phrases from these other sources. Clearly, it would be a simple but time-consuming process to reconstruct nearly the entire Book of Mormon from available contemporary sources. So if he's the doctor, how did he just save the patient? He just killed the patient. If he made his parameters so wide to neutralize mine as to be nothing more than anything else at the time, what did he do to the faith-promoting parallels? Is there some kind of discriminator in there that separate the two, that the good ones survive and the bad ones don't? He doesn't say. As far as chiasmus, if that's there, then that's there and it's over there. So I'm not going to deal with chiasmus. Now, here's some samples of the language. Like, for instance, altar of stones in the Book of Mormon. And in the editor's note from the Bookcraft edition, this is another testimony. It may seem easier to refer to the altar of stones as a stone altar. However, the way it is said in this verse is typical of the Hebrew language, which Nephi knew. This is another testimony that Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon. Well, some other writings of the era. Here's a guy who took a nap of sleep. Now, if you heard this joke before, I'll say it again. When you got home from church, you told your kids you're going to take a nap of sleep. But sometimes you didn't take a nap of sleep. You took a nap of something else. But I don't understand why they use nap of sleep. And then John Marshall, violent storm of snow instead of snow storm. And then even Sidney Rigdon in some of his writings, this night of storm. So how can the editors of the Bookcraft edition distinguish between the Hebrew and the contemporary? It's more likely that the Book of Mormon is just contemporary. Here's some other ones. The Book of Mormon talks about the land of liberty and that we'll come to this land of liberty. Well, again, may God prolong his days among us in this land of liberty, 1787. And another one, 1776, our founding fathers come into a land of liberty. Now, another defense of the Book of Mormon is in Hebrew, the conjunction and links compound numbers. The Book of Mormon is, again, credited as Hebrew because of the same usage. So 20 and 2nd, 781 in Mercy Otis Warren. So, is Mercy Otis Warren any more Hebrew now than Alma? And the same thing in John Marshall. He uses the numerals and then adds passed away. So if you combine the two, we now have the 20 and 2nd year passed away in 3rd Nephi. So nothing more, any more significant than the writers of the day. Ramsey, his soul was harrowed up, referring to Washington worrying about things. Warren, in her moral observations, likes to impute to the British that they're doing things out of a guilty conscience, so a consciousness of their own guilt. And then in Alma, his soul began to be harrowed up under a consciousness of his own guilt. And you can see some other verbiage similarities. Now, down at the bottom, where in the Book of Mormon it says the River Sidon, instead of the Sidon River, again, they're saying the River Delaware or the River Elk. Nothing more significant there than that. Ramsey, fixed in his resolution, a determined resolution, fixed in his determination, and then in the Book of Mormon, fixed in their minds with a determined resolution. And then you have some symbolism of the right hand of justice and the sword in the right hand. Now, this is Joseph Smith. If mobs come upon you anymore here, dung your gardens with them. We don't want any excitement, but after all we have done, we will rise up, Washington-like, and break off the hellish yoke that oppresses us, and we will not be mobbed. Joseph Smith was quite fond of Washington. He ran for president. Everybody remembers that. He liked to dress up and play general, ride his horse around. And I thought it was quite appropriate to show George Washington with his apron on. Notice the little symbol down in there? See the little square and compass right there? Isn't that nice? He did renounce Freemasonry later in life. These are Washington's orders to the troops. Remember, officers and soldiers, that you are freemen fighting for the blessings of liberty. And then you start seeing it showing up in the Book of Mormon. Ramsey, too, using these terms, maintain their rights and privileges and a free government. Warren, the same thing, their rights and privileges, a free government. Spalding himself, his little Indian tribes fight for their rights and privileges. And in Alma, the free men had sworn a covenant to maintain their rights and the privileges of their religion by a free government. Now, this is a handwritten letter from George Washington to the Canadians. We're not going to try to read this, but it was put into a pamphlet form, loaded into a trunk, and carried into Quebec in the invasion of 1775 with Benedict Arnold and his men. It was ultimately a failed campaign, but this leaflet went out there. We're going to go through it. This is Washington to the Canadians. Friends and brethren, and by the way, I have copies over there on the table after this is over if you want to take samples home. The unnatural contest between the English colonies and Great Britain has now risen to such a height that arms alone must decide it. The colonies, confiding in the justice of their cause and the purity of their intentions, have reluctantly appealed to that being in whose hands are all human events. He has hitherto smiled upon their virtuous efforts. The hand of tyranny has been arrested in its ravages, and the British arms, which have shone with so much splendor in every part of the globe, are now tarnished with disgrace and disappointment. Generals of approved experience who boasted of subduing this great continent find themselves circumscribed within the limits of a single city and its suburbs. That was Boston at the time. Suffering all the shame and distress of a siege, while the freeborn sons of America, animated by the genuine principles of liberty and love of their country, with increasing union, firmness, and discipline, repel every attack and despise every danger. Above all, we rejoice that our enemies have been deceived with regard to you. They have persuaded themselves, they have even dared to say, that the Canadians were not capable of distinguishing between the blessings of liberty and the wretchedness of slavery, that gratifying the vanity of a little circle of nobility would blind the eyes of the people of Canada. By such artifices, they hope to bend you to their views, but they have been deceived. Instead of finding in you that poverty of soul and baseness of spirit, they see with a chagrin equal to our joy that you are enlightened, generous, and virtuous, that you will not renounce your own rights or serve as instruments to deprive your fellow subjects of theirs. Come then, my brethren, unite with us in an indissoluble union. Let us run together to the same goal. We have taken up arms in defense of our liberty, our property, our wives, and our children. I hear any murmuring out there? We are determined to preserve them or die. We look forward with pleasure to that day, not far remote, we hope, when the inhabitants of America shall have one sentiment and the full enjoyment of the blessings of a free government. I don't think we have to read the rest of this, but he wraps it up here. The cause of America and of liberty is the cause of every virtuous American citizen, whatever may be his religion or his descent. The United Colonies know no distinction but such as slavery, corruption, and arbitrary domination may create. Come then, ye generous citizens, range yourselves under the standard of general liberty, against which all the force and artifice of tyranny will never be able to prevail. I am, etc., George Washington. Anything familiar show up there? Now, you know, that quote from Washington, Ramsey also uses the same word string in no relation to Washington's letter. He's talking here, Ramsey's talking about a charter in the New York State. But the string is there, liberty, property, wives, and children, and we find the strings over in the Book of Mormon that's what they're fighting for too. And when, you know, Moroni closes, I am Moroni, I am the leader of the Nephites. Well, Washington writes at the end of that letter, I am George Washington. Now, here's a patriot preacher, Peter Thatcher. A lot of them were involved in the Revolutionary War fight. He says that they fight for their wives, their children, their liberty, and their all, just like the Book of Mormon does. They are fighting for their homes and their liberties and their wives and their children and their all. Now here, this Timothy Dwight, another preacher, he pulls in a New Testament scripture to build his sermon. We fight for the lives, the honor, the safety of our wives and children, for the religion of our fathers, and for the liberty with which Christ hath made us free, where he's quoting Galatians. But what does the Book of Mormon do? They stand fast in that liberty wherewith God has made them free. The Book of Mormon author is doing the same thing that a preacher of the era is doing, relying on the same scripture to build his case. So when you say Joseph Smith stole from the Bible to build the Book of Mormon, technically true. But what if it's coming through a separate source? It's not necessarily straight from the Bible. So if we analyze Washington, Ramsey, and Thatcher compared to Alma, the closest thing I could find in the Bible was Nehemiah thinking, well, maybe they're all looking at some other source where Nehemiah says, fight for your brother and your sons and your daughters, your wives, and your houses. So it's kind of the same, but a little bit different. The thing is that the Alma verses and the Patriot verses are far closer to each other than they are to the biblical verse. Again, Washington from that letter, we are determined to preserve them or die. Thatcher, conquer or die. Ramsey, Warren, Marshall, Spalding, Book of Mormon. Determined to conquer in this place or die. And again, some other comparisons from that letter. You see how the standard of liberty shows up in other places too. And just a little context, Ramsey. Again, a vigorous, determined opposition was the only alternative for the preservation of their property, their children, and their wives, and in Book of Mormon, and were fixed with a determination to conquer our enemies and to maintain our lands, our possessions, our wives, and our children. Thomas Paine, he's elaborating on a principle that he, in common sense, is talking about the injustices committed by the King of England, and that these crimes cannot go unpunished, or in his words, nature would cease to be. Samuel McClintock, another patriot preacher, you know, makes the same philosophical point. If God changes, he would cease to be God. Alma, the work of justice cannot be destroyed. If so, God would cease to be God. And then there's some other comparisons there with preacher McClintock. So you see it all kind of just travels back and forth between these people. This is a placard. I forget where it is. Liberty poles were things erected by the Patriots. The British usually would chop them down when they found them. But Liberty poles were made of wood and resembled flagpoles. They were usually topped with a Liberty cap, a soft, roughly conical hat, and sometimes bore banners and streamers. Anybody see where this is going? There's a Liberty pole. Raising another Liberty pole. Oops. Don't tell Brother Packer, he's wearing a skirt. Alma, in memory of our God, our religion, our freedom, and our peace, our wives and our children, he fastened upon the end of a pole. So he takes that pole and does what with it? He goes out into the countryside, and there's the blessings of liberty again. And standard of liberty. So liberty poles are everywhere. Moroni's poles go out there. His standard of liberty gets erected. Warren now credits Washington with people coming to the aid of the Americans, and she terms it as multitudes flocked to the American standard. Ramsey flocked to their standard. Marshall flocked to his standard. A little pamphlet called A Freeman flocked to her standard. What's Alma say? Thousands did flock unto his standard. Ramsey and Warren are talking about the British actually planting their own flags, but still plant the standard, plant the standard, plant the standard shows up in Alma. And there's some more of that. This is for the benefit of YouTube viewers, too, because it's going to go up later. And there's some more verbiage. Ramsey and Warren, everybody's thinking ahead to the future generations, as does Alma. And like Art of War, that's pretty common. It's out there all over the place. And some more. We don't have to read all of them, but like I said, this is for YouTube benefit. Little things show up like this, and it's not unique to Ramsey, but it's still there. Usually during a retreat, they kept such a profound silence that they were not heard by the British. And in Alma, you know, get a maneuver done in a profound silence. And then they move by a secret way. In Al Helaman, they move through a secret way. And you can see verbiage in Ramsey looks a lot like verbiage in the Book of Mormon. There's some of the causes they're fighting for itemized by Ramsey. And lo and behold, what's going on in the Book of Mormon? Am I clicking too fast for some of these, by the way? Everybody's getting the idea? Okay. Warren, same thing. There's a chance Warren probably read Ramsey. She was very well read, and he did predate her. You notice when Marshall gave credits, he didn't credit her. Whether or not it was published, I don't remember. I like the one at the bottom that Warren talks about, to take up arms in defense of their rights. You find it, to take up arms in defense of their country, in the Book of Mormon. Another patriot preacher. What are they fighting for? The cause of God. Same thing, support and maintain the cause of God, cause of the Christians. And that's one major theme. The cause of their country, or the justice of their cause, was in the mind of the Americans, we didn't do anything to deserve this. The British attacked us. We are innocent. So our fight is the cause we are fighting for is to defend ourselves from this unjust attack. Warren often talked about classes. She didn't like classes between people. And, you know, you just get the same thing going on in the Book of Mormon. Ramsey, he talks about what's motivating the British, the lust of power and gain. Washington, too, the love of power and the proneness to abuse it. Warren, the love of domination and an uncontrolled lust of arbitrary power. And power and gain shows up in ether. And this is all word for word from the Magic Stone. Now, interesting in Alma, again, what are they fighting for, like the center, Alma 43, 45? The Nephites were inspired by a better cause, for they were not fighting for monarchy nor power, but they were fighting for their homes and their liberties, their wives and their children. Well, there's another of Joseph Smith's anachronisms, uncorrected, that monarchy dates back from 1390. I'm going to intrigue you with this. If Spalding was writing this, and he's a veteran of the American Revolution, he's trying to retell this story, he doesn't care to be technically accurate or historically accurate. He might have been the one that used monarchy, and he didn't care that it was an anachronism. Joseph Smith may not have picked up on it if he's reading Spalding's writings. Just like when I mentioned how Marshall, if you didn't read Ramsey, you wouldn't know that you're reading Ramsey and Marshall. You may not know that you're reading Spalding in the Book of Mormon. Nor would Joseph Smith know, because he would have had to read every book Spalding was borrowing from. Spirit of freedom, it's everywhere. Ignominious, that's pretty funny. That's usually being hung. It's in Gulliver's Travels. Jonathan Edwards is a preacher we're going to get to. But to die this way is to die without honor. Usually if a soldier was captured, he'd rather be shot than hung. Because if he's going to die, at least let people know he got shot in battle rather than hung as a spy. Stratagem. It's everywhere. Usually when you read the Book of Mormon in a vacuum, you know, you read it with the blinders on, you're not looking outside for any context, these little words all seem unique. But when you see them pop up there next to other ones that are the same, all of a sudden it just what? It melts away to nothing. There's really no uniqueness there. Now, what's funny is Mercy Otis Warren has a little bit of the poetry going on. And she, like, instead of saying the more correct term of commander-in-chief, she likes to flip it around and say chief commander, as does the Book of Mormon. Whenever I read that in the Book of Mormon, I thought that was unique, and it's not. Same thing with her watery grave, and Spalding picks up watery tomb. Now, the groanings of the earth, that's probably a lift from the Bible. We'll get to that in a little bit here. But so you can see that some of her prose appears to be showing up. And that's what I meant there, that, you know, you may say, well, maybe First Nephi got it from Romans, and maybe Warren got it from Romans, but when you look at Warren versus Nephi, it's a lot closer than either of them versus Romans. There again, just some more of her. See how she foreshadows at the bottom? But we shall see, yada, yada, yada. But behold, we shall see, yada, yada, yada. She gives an account of that pamphlet from Washington being taken into Canada. So she says the command of this little band had been given to Colonel Arnold with his little army, almost exhausted by hunger and fatigue. And they carried a liberal supply of provisions. And over in Alma, you can get in almost one chapter all the same verbiage. And like I said, every time I read it in the Book of Mormon, it all seemed unique to me that nobody spoke like this. Now, I also discovered if you look at some of them, you get a little wordiness going on. Now, in my mind, when I see wordiness, what does this tell you about the author who's being more wordy? Do we have any English teachers? Nobody? Yes?
Yes.
As an English teacher, if you saw this in a book report, what would you tell the student?
Say you're still plagiarizing. I don't care if you're putting in one or two words.
Thank you. Thank you. Buy that man a beer later. Yeah, that was my impression. Now, they flip them, too. You can get back and forth, reverse the process. But what that tells me is the Book of Mormon author is very familiar with the terms. Doesn't matter if you get them in the right order. You're still using them. So even if you reverse them, who cares? And again, you're going to see more and more repeats of the same verbiage in these histories. How long should I leave that up there, by the way? Because I just click, I'm not knowing. Everybody's good?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, she is the poet. Remember, she's got a way to turn a phrase. The technically accurate term when the British surrendered was to ground their weapons, which Ramsey describes as literally a procession of army men. They lay their weapons in a pile. Music's playing. It's very regimented. But she uses the more picturesque scene of laying down their arms at the feet of the victorious Washington. And the Book of Mormon author does the same thing, talking about the visual imagery of putting the arms at the feet of the conqueror. Now, wild beasts, you know, that's everywhere. They could all be looking at Ezekiel, but again, another point is that if you're going to use the term wild beasts, you don't necessarily have to be thinking of Ezekiel. It's just out there in all these different authors, including the Book of Mormon. Whitefield, he's another preacher we're going to get to. Now, Spalding, I debated using this because it's very racially insensitive, but it's indicative of the times. In his little story, his Roman sailors that are shipwrecked in America, they're going to move along. His main character says, surrounded by innumerable hordes of human beings who resemble in manners the orangutan, let us keep aloof from them. Now, you ever wonder why maybe there's some racism in the Book of Mormon? But that the point here is he's not being original again. Even in a racial slur, he's repeating what other people are saying. This Robert Corm, this was an article on education. You know, if the present race of American Indians should shortly become extinct, it would be impossible for posterity to form any judgment of them, whether they were a species of orangutan or rational beings. Now, William Lynn is actually saying here, he's quoting Thomas Jefferson. He wrote a pamphlet trying to stop the presidency of Thomas Jefferson, and where he says that, implying that Thomas Jefferson said that the slaves are connected in blood with the orangutan. So point being, when Spalding uses it, again, even in this regard, he is not being original. He's just pretty much a borrower of everything. Now, here's a paragraph from Warren and a paragraph in the Spalding story. In the first paragraph, she is talking about how the British squandered an opportunity to spread Christianity. She faulted them for that. They should have been the standard bearer of Christianity, but they basically spread war and destruction. In the Spalding story, a great teacher teaches a wayward band of Indians and enlightens them. But as you can see, the structure of these two paragraphs tell me that Spalding had just read that. Otherwise, the odds of finding all that in that same order to me are astounding. Now, to connect those two, there's some others. She uses avarice and ambition and avarice as these causes of all this trouble. Spalding's Indians go to war over the same petty things, avarice and ambition. Rivers of human blood as a result, same thing in the Spalding story. Now I'm going to bring in some other things here. The Gordon Riots of 1778 in England was because of this guy, Lord Gordon. He didn't like the idea that, let me go back. He did not like the idea that the British government was giving aid to Catholics. He's a Protestant. This was not good. Organizes a march. The march quickly degenerates into rioting and looting, people dying. Warren refers to this altercation. She says 50 or 60,000 persons assembled in St. George's Fields under the appellation of the Protestant Associators, distinguished by blue cockades in their hats, a badge which they endeavored to affix to many well-meaning persons. Now, that paragraph I showed you that looked almost identical to Spalding, right after that, in his little story, he starts another story. It had been the custom for several ages for the king and chiefs of the Kentucks to have the exclusive right to wear in their caps a bunch of blue feathers. So this other group wants to wear the blue feathers. They get into a battle. So then Spalding kind of pontificates on things. A blue feather, a badge of preeminence. It is pride. It is cursed ambition and avarice which devastate the world and produce rivers of human blood. Well, the point I'm trying to make here is right after that big paragraph that looks just like each other, then you get the blue cockades in the hats and the blue feathers in their caps, and it tells me that Spalding was reading Warren, picking up ideas not only with prose, but with storylines. We don't have to cover all these, but just more storylines that he may have been interested in. She uses other terms. This is not necessarily unique to her, but she refers to the British officers as being effeminated by luxury, that they have it all good and the poor Americans have it all bad, and they sit around in their drawing rooms, you know, snuffing snuff and drinking tea while everybody else is suffering. But Spalding picks it up too. Now, interestingly enough, Warren refers to Washington as Fabius, the American Fabius, and just lo and behold, Spalding picks up Fabius as the name of his main character in that Roman story. And just some other verbiage that looks like Spalding picked up from her. And funny enough, too, Warren refers to a particularly cruel British officer as a monster. Spalding has a particularly cruel chief that's a monster, and in Alma, a particularly bad person is a monster. Here again, in Spalding, you see some more of the same kind of prose showing up, where she describes Indians as having copper-colored skin, more poetic way of putting it. He picks it up, humanity dropping a tear. I even caught Rigdon. It's not necessarily Rigdon copying from Warren here in this case. That's kind of out there. But nevertheless, with Warren and Ramsey and the Book of Mormon, you kind of get one-stop shopping. Everything's there in the same books. Now, here's another patriot preacher, Isaac Bacchus. He talks about how tough it is to describe things. No tongue nor pen can fully describe what's going on. Same thing with Warren. Neither the pen of the historian or the imagination of the poet can fully describe. Spalding does the same thing in the Book of Mormon. It is impossible for the tongue to describe or for man to write a perfect description of the horrible scene of blood and carnage. She liked to dwell on the pathetic and the sentimental. Women and children in this instance were burned alive in a place where they thought they'd be safe by, she often referred to renegade Indians, renegade British soldiers, Hessian, German assassins, or mercenaries. And you could loosely interpret them as being the Gadianton robbers, that they you know, march through the countryside unseen, unheard, until they attack you out of nowhere and destroy your lives and your property. And again, you know, in Alma 14, and when those people, the women and children were burned in a fire, I just figured, you know, why not find it there? Interestingly enough, here Marshall talks about a patriot. that first he engaged his pen, and afterwards his sword. So if words don't work, we're going to go to sword. Alma 61, whatsoever evil we cannot resist with our words, yea, such as rebellions and dissensions, let us resist them with our swords. So again, words first, swords later. Some bloody verbiage by Warren, all showing up in the Book of Mormon. Same thing with Ramsey, a lot of the same kind of bloody verbiage. Visual imagery here. Warren is referring to the British atrocities, which she liked to harp on, in India. The Ganges and the Indus rivers were reddened with the blood and covered with the slaughtered bodies of men. Why? Because the British threw all those, or the dead were thrown in the river. Same thing in Alma, throwing the bodies of the Lamanites who had been slain into the waters. You know, and every time you read that in the Book of Mormon, you imagine all these bodies floating down the river. Same thing in Alma again. Who had been slain upon the bank of the river were cast into the waters. Again, in Warren, the carnage was great. She's quoting a British officer here. We trampled thick on the dead bodies that were strewed in the way. Spalding kind of picks up that same thing with his battles. The field was widely strewed and in many places thickly covered with human bodies. And in Spalding, the ground which was strewed thick with the slain. And in Ether, the same visual imagery, scenes of bloodshed and carnage, that the whole face of the land was covered with the bodies of the dead, leaving the bodies of both men, women, and children strewed upon the face of the land. This is General Herkimer, Battle of Oriskany, 100 miles east of Palmyra. It's considered a graveyard right now. The lore of this battle was he was mostly cut to pieces, his men, most of them lost in an ambush. In a publication in 1820, which is referring to an earlier publication, the lore of this is that the dead were not interred. You have bodies laying on the ground, unburied, because the battles are moving swiftly. So we don't have to read the whole thing, but this one Elkanah Watson, he was ushered down to the battlefield at Oriskany, and he himself said, I noticed numerous human bones strewn upon the surface of the earth. And in the Book of Mormon, you find that people wander around and they find these piles of bones, uninterred dead on the land. And it was 100 miles east of Palmyra. Peter Thatcher, another patriot preacher, same allusion. We mourn the brave men who have fallen in the wilderness and whose bones are now whitening in the sun. Same thing in the Book of Alma, bones on the earth. And you get little things like this in Warren, that dissensions ran high among the inhabitants of Philadelphia and in Helaman. There was much contention and many dissensions, in which there were an exceeding many who departed out of the land of Zarahemla. Desertions. And then at the bottom, the patience and fortitude with which it was endured by the faithful part of the army. Their exceeding faith and their patience, they endure these battles. Intrigues. Combinations. Now, not all the soldiers were quite happy fighting for the Americans. They often get paid for quite long periods of time. Sometimes they threatened to march to Philadelphia. They were determined to march on Congress to obtain a redress of grievance. And what does the Book of Mormon threaten? Except you do administer unto our relief, behold, I will come unto you, even in the land of Zarahemla, and smite you. And isn't it funny that Zarahemla and Philadelphia sound a little alike? And then terms for God, same thing shared between Warren, Book of Mormon. I used blue for adieu. But see, when you read adieu, critics of the Book of Mormon say, yeah, see, the Book of Mormon's false because the word adieu is there. Well, it's no more false or true than any other author using the term adieu. More terms, Ramsey, when you didn't have things go right, you were disappointed. Same thing in the Book of Mormon. If you were really embarrassed, you were embarrassed. And so, same thing, military embarrassments, you got beaten pretty badly. Or when you had somebody stop you in your progress, you were checked. Now, Ramsey used grammatically good form. The Americans and the British ultimately drove and were driven by each other. But Mosiah, it kind of breaks down. And they were driven back, or they drove them back. Well, who? And a maneuver in Ramsey. The Americans moved from their encampment on the Skip Pack Road in the evening of the 3rd of October with the intention of surprising their adversaries early next morning and to attack both wings in front and rear at the same time. And in Nephi, you have a night march, so you can attack in the front and rear at the same time. The colonials would throw up, in her terms, defenses almost overnight, astonishing the British. She says, astonished at the appearance of such strong and defensible works rising, as it were, in a night. Ramsey talks about similar things in places of security. And Alma, the Lamanites were astonished exceedingly because of the wisdom of the Nephites in preparing their places of security. To their uttermost astonishment, they were prepared. A ditch and a bank is a pretty common thing. We're going to get into that here in a minute. Same terms, Book of Mormon, Ramsey. This is Washington from his first expedition down the Ohio to get rid of the French. He describes the fort. The bastions are made of piles driven into the ground and about 12 feet above and sharp at top. Well, in that antiquated language, he's basically describing the ditch, the bank, the palisades of wood trees, fairly common. And Book of Mormon had them. Transitional phrases. Ramsey would say, thus ended the campaign of 17 whatever, Mosiah, thus ended whatever, and they move along. Now Warren, she was a woman beyond her time. She had great anxiety about the American Indian. This is her referring to them. However, the generous or humane mind may revolt at the idea. There appears a probability that they will be hunted from the vast American continent, if not from the face of the globe. And in Helaman, Book of Mormon author, laments the same thing, that in the later times, the promises of the Lord have been extended to our brethren, the Lamanites, and notwithstanding the many afflictions which they shall have, and notwithstanding they shall be driven to and fro upon the face of the earth, and be hunted, and shall be smitten and scattered abroad, having no place for refuge, the Lord shall be merciful unto them. Now here's where I think it all wraps up, and I know these are long quotes, but like I said, they're for YouTube benefit too. Here's Ramsey. This is referring to the Tories or the Loyalists. It is the general opinion of the Americans that the continuance of the war and the asperity with which it had been carried on was more owing to the machinations of their own countrymen who had taken part with the royal government than to their British enemies. It is certain that the former had been most active in predatory excursions and most forward in scenes of blood and murder, the authors of so great a share of the general distress. Warren, they were again, for the Tories, they were responsible for all the additional blood that had been spilt by the addition of their weight in the scale of the enemy. Now listen carefully to Alma. Yea, had it not been for the war which broke out among ourselves, yea, were it not for these kingmen who caused so much bloodshed among ourselves, yea, at the time we were contending among ourselves, if we had united our strength as we hitherto have done, yea, had it not been for the desire of power and authority which those king men had over us, had they been true to the cause of our freedom and united with us and gone forth against our enemies instead of taking up their swords against us, which was the cause of so much bloodshed among ourselves, yea, if we had gone forth against them in the strength of the Lord, we should have dispersed our enemies. That was the entire sentiment of the historians against the Loyalists or the Tories. Was if they would have all been in one mind, it would have been over a lot sooner. So does anybody here see it coming through? Now, once the British were evicted, the Loyalists had a problem. They would have no more protection. And the colonials took their revenge. So she's referring to this after the British are retreating or driven out. But in this war, they seem to have lost those generous feelings of compassion to the vanquished foe and suffered themselves to be governed either by vindictive passions or their feelings of resentment. So revenge is the word of the day, back from the colonials to the Tories. And in Moroni, remember as things devolve later in the book, for so exceedingly do they anger that it seemeth me that they have no fear of death and they have lost their love one towards another and they thirst after blood and revenge continually. Anybody know who Tecumseh is? It's a town, right? Somewhere? Tecumseh, Illinois? He tried to unite the Indian tribes of the eastern states to drive the white man out permanently. It never really worked for him. He dies in the War of 1812, actually 1813. But follow this. Tecumseh dies in the Battle of Moravian Town. Here's Alma. And it came to pass that the army which was sent by Moroni, which was led by a man whose name was Teancum, did meet the people of Morianton. And so stubborn were the people of Morianton, being inspired by his wickedness and his flattering words, that a battle commenced between them, in the which Teancum did slay Morianton and defeat his army and took them prisoners. Well, anyway, what I see going on here is, way back to that map I showed you, is the author is just picking stuff from what he knows, working them into a story. Thomas Paine, back to common sense, another philosophical point. He says, where, say some, is the king of America? I'll tell you, friend, he reigns above. And the same sentiment in the Book of Mormon, that there was not to be a king on this land, but the king of this land was in heaven. And Paine has other terms that show up in the Book of Mormon, like robber, murder, pretty common stuff. Declaration of Independence. Remember, Washington's letter to the Canadians started with friends and brethren. You can find it in the Declaration of Independence. What did Jonathan Swift write? Yes, I asked this question. If anybody was here, they know. Don't answer it. But I asked, what is Gulliver's first name? Lemuel. Oh, you said it. Richard Packham in 2005 knew that answer. Lemuel Gulliver. I never knew that until I read it. And I've been accused of only using a computer to come up with these comparisons, but I have read every single reference that's noted up here. I did it the old-fashioned way. But anyway, I came across, I'm like, well, okay. I didn't know Lemuel Gulliver was Gulliver. But in one of the chapters, Lemuel says, having been born of plain, honest parents who were just able to give me a tolerable education, and it sounds a lot like Nephi. And Nephi has a brother named what? Lemuel. Now, I'm going to move a little bit into a religious area here. We're going to move away from war into religion. Remember this story? I think it was this Korihor. And he also testified unto the people that all mankind should be saved at the last day and that they need not fear or tremble, but they might lift up their heads and rejoice. For the Lord had created all men and also redeemed all men. And in the end, all men should have eternal life. Well, he got dragged before the tribunal, didn't he? If I remember the story right. So is this just out of the blue, or is the Book of Mormon author following something? Who knew that? Who said that?
Arza.
Okay, Arza, you get a pass. All right. Yes. Now, the salvation of all men, I forget the date, slip me for a minute here. The author's name is not on this original work. Right here it says Charles Chauncey D.D. Well, first it was anonymous, and then later it, you know, came out that Charles Chauncey was the head, you would say, of the Universalists. And what's happening? Everybody's going to get saved. No big deal. Well, that didn't sit right with a lot of the Puritans. So there's a rebuttal. Jonathan Edwards Jr., son of the great Jonathan Edwards, Puritan preacher of New England, he writes an entire book rebutting the entire book of how we're going to be saved forever. Again, I've read these. They're quite laborious reads. But anyway, he makes his point here, but here's what goes on. Now, Edwards is trying to make a point, opposing this punishment for short term or slap on the wrist. He says, it is generally agreed that murder deserves death. But suppose a law should be made by which no murderer should be punished with death or with any other punishment to be continued longer than till he should repent. Would not such a law as this, compared with the law as it now stands naturally and directly, tend to encourage murder? Alma 42 makes the same point. Now, if there were a law given, if a man murdered, he should die, would he be afraid? He would die if he should murder? Same thing, Edwards Jr. It will not be denied that if there were no punishment threatened to the wicked, it would naturally and directly encourage them to persist in vice. Same thing, Alma 42. And also, if there was no law given against sin, men would not be afraid to sin. So the Book of Mormon author is siding with the Edwardses. Now, if you look at Edwards' rebuttal, these are all non-biblical terms. You can find Alma 42 chock full of this Reader's Digest version of the debate between Edwards Jr. and Charles Chauncey. And again, to some of my critics, this is nothing more than permutations of words with no meaning. Edwards also refers to a specific term called the merits of Christ. Moroni 2, the merits of Christ. They're not getting this from the Bible. That goes back to John Calvin's time. The concept of, well, are we saved by what Christ did, his merit, or are we saved by God's grace? They have this little, you know, debate going on. It really doesn't matter. What my point here is, it's showing up in the Book of Mormon again, and you can find it in Edwards. Now, how many of you read that infinite atonement in many Sunday school classes, priesthood classes? Well, it was already said by Edwards Jr. But if we deserve an endless punishment, sin is an infinite evil and so requires an infinite atonement. His point again against Charles Chauncey, that this goes on forever. Your punishment goes on forever, the saving goes on forever. And the same term, infinite atonement, is showing up in the Book of Mormon. Edwards says, yet from eternity and to eternity are in fact used among us to express an absolute eternity. Alma, from eternity to all eternity. Now, you all know about View of the Hebrews, but Jonathan Edwards Jr. knew Mohican. He was on a mission to the Mohicans. He writes a little pamphlet, The Observations on the Language of the Mohican Indians, in which the extent of that language in North America is shown, its genius grammatically traced, and some of its peculiarities and some instances of analogy between that and the Hebrew are pointed out. He made the same mistake that Ethan Smith did. They both thought these guys were speaking Hebrew. They found similarities, itemized them. So not only, you know, does the Book of Mormon say they're Hebrews, Edwards is saying it, Ethan Smith's saying it. Now here's his dad, Jonathan Edwards Sr., the most famous Puritan preacher, hellfire damnation of the New England era, Great Awakening. His most famous sermon. Anybody read this in school?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And what are we but that little spider? God is holding you above that flame. Any old time, off you go into the flames. Because it's his will. Nothing you can do about it. Edwards always tried to scare people straight. He didn't love you straight, he scared you straight. He uses biblical paraphrasing, same as the guy before him, where they combine two biblical verses, hardness of heart and blindness of mind. Ether does the same biblical paraphrase. Point here is also down below where Edwards talks about weeping and wailing and gnashing your teeth. You can see in Mosiah, again, the paraphrase are closer to the preacher than they are to the biblical source, which makes me again think that when people say Joseph Smith stole from the Bible, well, he didn't necessarily have to go straight from the Bible. He could get it third hand through other writers. Edwards' sermon, our first parents were lost, and they were immediately in a doleful state of spiritual death. If we respect temporal death, that was also fulfilled. Alma 42 again. Our first parents. You can't find that in the Bible. And see how he couples up temporal and spiritual together? Another Edwards sermon. It is therefore it is called death. It is eternal death, of which temporal death, with all its awful circumstances, is but a faint shadow. The struggles and groans and gasps of the body when dying, its pale, awful visage when dead, its state in the dark grave when it is eaten with worms, or but a faint shadow of the state of the soul under the second death. And again, in an Alma Book of Mormon sermon, you can find second death, temporal death coupled up in the same passage. A little bit of Edwards' verbiage. Sounds a lot like the Book of Mormon, doesn't it? And I used to think racking torments, you know, that was unique. Nope, not at all. But see, Edwards was inspired to say the same things that the Book of Mormon authors said, didn't he? Just like the founding father, which I've, believe me, this is not unique. I've heard this so many times from emailers. Well, it's obvious the founding fathers were inspired by God, and they would say the same things the Nephites said. See how it all works. condescension of God. You know, you read that in the Book of Mormon, think that's kind of unique. Nope, Edwards is already talking about condescension unto the men. Mary Lyon, now she has nothing to do with the Book of Mormon, but I threw this in here because she founded the first female seminary in Mount Holyoke. Here's a sermon of hers. How vain to resist God. Did you ever see the little insect fall into the flame, see it struggle and strive to escape? How vain. Just so you are in the hands of an angry God. Well, who's she quoting? Edwards. She's quite fond of Edwards. You don't have to say it, but you see it right there. So Edwards' influence through his son, through her, through the Book of Mormon is all trailing down from New England. George Whitefield, circuit preacher, same era of time, devoted to the Edwardses. He rides the circuit. He's from England. He sounds a lot like Edwards, and by consequence, the Book of Mormon. Our first parents had not been long in this state of innocence. He says state of probation, temporal, spiritual. Again, identical to the Book of Mormon. So compare a Whitefield sermon, an Edwards sermon, a Book of Mormon sermon, word for word from that glowing stone in the hat. Eluda Aquiano was a slave. He purchased his own freedom and converted to Christianity. He wrote a story of his life, published, I forget the date again, I'm not good with dates. But here's what he says. I came to a church crowded with people. The churchyard was full likewise, and a number of people were even mounted on ladders looking in at the windows. I thought this was a strange sight, as I had never seen churches either in England or the West Indies crowded in this manner before. I therefore made bold to ask some people the meaning of all this. And they told me the Reverend George Whitefield, spelled incorrectly here, was preaching. I had often heard of this gentleman and had wished to see and hear him, but I had never before had an opportunity. I now therefore resolved to gratify myself with the sight, and I pressed in amidst the multitude. When I got into the church, I saw this pious man exhorting the people with the greatest fervor and earnestness and sweating as much as I ever did while in slavery on Montserrat Beach. I was very much struck and impressed with this. I thought it strange. I had never seen divines exert themselves in this manner before, and I was no longer at a loss to account for the thin congregations they preached to. So those boring English preachers couldn't bring them in like George Whitefield did. But if you read Aquiano's book, all of a sudden he looks like Book of Mormon. So you could make the premature assumption that, well, maybe the Book of Mormon author read Eluda Aquiano's interesting narrative. Not necessarily. If the Book of Mormon author was taking his stuff from the Edwardses or Whitefield, and Eluda Aquiano just said he was inspired by Whitefield, then there's no reason to believe that, you know, there's no difference between the two. King Benjamin. Oh, excuse me. Benjamin Franklin. I love this. He's speaking about Whitefield. I happened soon after to attend one of his sermons, in the course of which I perceived he intended to finish with a collection. And I silently resolved he should get nothing from me. I had in my pocket a handful of copper money, 3 or 4 silver dollars, and 5 pistoles in gold. As he proceeded, I began to soften and concluded to give the coppers. Another stroke of his oratory made me ashamed of that and determined me to give the silver. And finally, he finished so admirably that I emptied my pocket wholly into the collector's just gold and all. Now, the second paragraph, I had to throw that in, I just love it. Some of Mr. Whitefield's enemies affected to suppose that he would apply these collections to his own private emolument. But I, who was intimately acquainted with him, being employed in printing his sermons and journals, never had the least suspicion of his integrity. Anyway, so Benjamin Franklin is printing these sermons, and they're being dispersed. Now, Whitefield, sometimes his sermons were transcribed because he's up there. He's not necessarily writing them. But anyway, in this one transcription of a funeral, he's actually quoting somebody else. He says, "Crowns, crowns, crowns of glory shall adorn this head of mine ere long, and stretching up added palms, palms, palms shall ere long fill these hands of mine." So he also wraps up some sermons with the same word string. All honor, power, glory, might, majesty, and dominion, blah, 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 blah. Now, I thought, well, maybe he's picking that up from the Bible. So the closest I could find were these two, Jude and Chronicles, where some of the same words are there. But you can see the pattern, Whitefield sticking with a pattern. Now, go to Joseph Smith's dedication to the Kirtland Temple by Revelation. 76, 77, 78. With palms in our hands and crowns of glory upon our heads, with glory, honor, power, majesty, might, dominion, and he uses the triplicate, oh, hear, oh, hear, oh, hear us, O Lord. When you look at a Whitefield sermon and a Smith revelation, a lot of the same things are showing up. And then I stumble upon these other little things like where Whitefield says sealed in heaven, and it's no longer unique now in the Book of Mormon. And then when Whitefield's up there on the podium, you know, being very demonstrative, oh, that I could but persuade one poor soul to fly to Christ. And here we are in the Book of Mormon. Oh, that I were an angel, and oh, that. He didn't have a lot of fans outside of his followers. You can see down here it says credulity, superstition, and fanaticism. This cartoonist of the day is commenting on Whitefield. But his influence cannot be mitigated. I mean, Whitefield had the influence at the time. Joseph Smith, my mind became somewhat partial to the Methodist sect. Who did the Methodists adopt but Whitefield and Edwards? Confession of Faith. The Calvinist Methodist Confession of Faith was brought by Welsh settlers to the central New York state circa 1826. For 6 years around 1742, George Whitefield was the leader of Welsh Calvinists. Now here's the Confession of Faith. The Father, an eternal person. The Son, an eternal person. The Holy Ghost, an eternal person. But three persons, one eternal God. And the Confession of Faith is in the Book of Alma. Christ the Son, God the Father, and the Holy Spirit, which is one eternal God. Another Whitefield sermon. May God in his infinite mercy deliver us all through Jesus Christ, to whom with thee, O Father, and thee, O Holy Ghost, three persons and one eternal God, be ascribed as his most due all honor, power, might, majesty, glory, and dominion, now and forevermore. Where do you think Joseph Smith's getting his notes from? Here's B.H. Roberts. There can be no doubt but what the style of preaching, exhortation, warning, praying, admonition, together with the things emphasized and the ends aimed at in such work of the Christian ministry as came to the attention of Joseph Smith, were all largely and deeply influenced by those first and greatest evangelical popular preachers of Protestant Christianity, John Wesley, George Whitefield, Jonathan Edwards, Dr. Thomas Coke, et al. In saying this, I am not unmindful of the fact that these great lights of the Protestant churches wrought their work in the generation preceding the one in which Joseph Smith lived, and that he never came in contact with them, Wesley, Whitefield, and Dr. Coke on their several visits to America, or with Dr. Edwards in New England. Still, that revival of religion which marked the early decades of the 19th century, with which Joseph Smith was familiar, took on pretty much all of its coloring from the spirit and manner in which these above-named evangelists conducted their work. The generation of men following them, the men with whom Joseph Smith came in contact during his boyhood and early manhood, and through whom he heard of these giants of the altar Protestantism of the former generation, were but imitators of these in spirit, in matter, and in manner. I could have said that myself, but I have to plagiarize Roberts. Another Edwards sermon. Watch closely as this follows in Jacob. How have some of you neglected your children's souls, and not only so, but have corrupted their minds by your bad examples? In Jacob, the children are also corrupted by your bad examples. Same sermon. How much of a spirit of pride has appeared in you, which is in a peculiar manner the spirit and condemnation of the devil? How have some of you vaunted yourselves in your apparel, others in their riches? Jacob 2. You have obtained many riches, and because some of you have obtained more abundantly than that of your brethren, you are lifted up in the pride of your hearts and wear stiff necks and high heads, and because of the costliness of your apparel. Same sermon. And what abominable lasciviousness have some of you been guilty of? How have you indulged yourself from day to day and from night to night in all manner of unclean imaginations? Funny enough, Jacob picks up the word lasciviousness after all that. How about the concept of the devil being miserable and wants everybody else to be? We all thought that was Book of Mormon doctrine, right? So did Dr. Edwards. So much like the spirit of the devil, who because he is miserable himself, is unwilling that others should be happy. I'm going to wrap it up with this one. What time is it, by the way? I have no idea what time it is. Excellent. This is an account of the taking of Fort Ticonderoga by the Americans in Ramsey and Warren. The commander, surprised in his bed, was called upon to surrender the fort. He asked, "By what authority?" Colonel Allen replied, "I demand it in the name of the great Jehovah and the Continental Congress." That could just as well be easily influenced from the Masonic lodges that they were all members of. Here's the last one. This is from my son in the MTC before he left just a little while ago. "There's a caffeine cartel on the third floor of my building. They're selling Mountain Dew for $3 a pop. So all is not well in Zion." Thank you.